Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Radomir Talcott is the research director of the Legatum Institute and has recently written a piece for The Critic Online about cosmetic democracy. It's an interesting concept, Radomir. I think we still live in a democracy. I'm looking forward to exercising my vote sometime, probably in the autumn of next year. In what sense is that exercise a cosmetic one?
Thank you very much, Graham, and you're absolutely right. We do indeed still live in a democracy, and I'm also looking forward to exercising my vote at some point next year. I've suggested this concept of cosmetic democracy because I think, however, that there has been a shift in the public sense of how well democracy is functioning in our country. And that's really come to the fore over the last 12 months or so. And I think there are particular reasons for this. They're to do with the so-called Partygate investigation into particularly former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, to do with the civil service treatment of and relationship with ministers like Suella Braverman in particular, and I'm mentioning two senior pro-Brexit ministers there advisedly, and they're also to do with which policies stick, which policies that in particular a conservative government puts forward, can it actually get done? And my sense is that the culture, and it's been called a groupthink, of the civil service, or sometimes named the blob, is now so clearly on the left, and that in the last generation or so, rules have been created by the civil service that allow them so much de facto control over policy and such a strong informational advantage over ministers that there is an erosion of the capacity of democratically elected politicians, the representatives of the demos in our democracy, to really get things done, to really enact change. And so what's happening, I think, is that while democracy continues, while elections continue to happen, the people that we elect can't get through much of the democratically chosen agenda after an election and are increasingly becoming what I have called frontmen, whose job, I'm afraid, has become a rather cynical one and is to style a lot of the policy that emerges from this fundamentally left-wing civil service as conservative.
Well, I wonder how much of that analysis is entirely true. The civil service has long been the bane of ministers' lives, and ministers' lives of both main parties, who have seen in the civil service a desire to protect its own interests, a desire to carry on the smooth working of the machine, a desire not to be disruptive, and insofar as not to be disruptive, to therefore attempt to slow down, thwart, or at any rate put speed bumps in the way of government initiatives. Indeed, that the whole premise of the 1980s TV sitcom Yes Minister was based on that very idea. Are you suggesting though that there is something different and more politicized about the relationship between the civil service and more broadly what's dismissively called the blob and the government of the day?
I do think there's been a shift. I do think there's been an acceleration here, yes. You're absolutely right. There's always been a degree of this, and this was very well illustrated by Yes Minister, the Sir Humphrey culture, where the civil servant, particularly the senior civil servant, had, I suppose, an informational advantage, an advantage in experience over the elected minister, who was a generalist, may not be there for very long. And so that parodied very well some civil service habits that many former special advisors like myself could tell you about, which include things like waiting out ministers and putting at the top of the inbox of the next minister the legislative priorities that supposedly the former minister was just about to get on with. So there's always been something there, but I think a couple of things have changed really in the last generation or so. The first is the administrative state, or the quangocracy, that was created in the Blair years in order to connect the British public sector with the European Union, especially, where so-called experts, or more exactly just bureaucrats, were put in control of a great deal of policymaking and public spending, in short, the sinews of our national life, and connected on the policy level with Brussels. So fundamentally began going around British democracy, and a lot of that remains. It has been disconnected from the mothership of Brussels, but a good deal of that is now basically dragging its feet and not really engaging in divergence from the EU in post-Brexit reform. And this has created a shift. It's created a cultural shift that is now dislocates it a great deal from the choice of the British people since 2016 to leave the European Union. And that shows. I think other issues spring from that. They include reforms that also happened in the New Labour era, particularly a piece of legislation called the Constitutional Reform and Governance Act that came through at the very end of the New Labour era under Gordon Brown, that also put the civil service even more in control of the state and also ultimately on the outcomes of government. And other issues like the sock puppet funding of increasingly left-wing charities by the state in order to lobby for the expansion of the state. So I think there is a whole culture that's set in now that feels quite dominant over any democratic process.
Well, there's a lot to pick up on there in what you've just been saying. I'd like to start, though, by suggesting that what you see as an attempt by the blob to get in the way of a government's mandate is actually the useful attempt by administrators to point out the realities of life to a government that may not have fought through its intended reforms. And an important element in the making and framing of legislation and regulation is surely that ability to give government ministers informed advice on the problems and complexities standing in the way of what they're trying to do.
You're absolutely right to point that out. And the civil service always has to be prepared to push back when civil servants frankly believe that ministers are wrong. And it's also useful for civil servants to have a different viewpoint to ministers of whichever party. So the purpose here is not to look for the politicization of the civil service in another direction, for example. So I agree with that. That said, I think that this shift that's going on has now gone too far. And we've seen some examples of that, especially in the last few months. So the funding of charities like Stop Funding Hate by the state, and this is a charity that organized the advertising boycott of GB News, of the Phoenix Education Trust, which appears to be behind certain decolonization materials now aimed at school children, and particularly the apparent threat by staff in the Home Office to strike over the government's Rwanda plan. Now, I acknowledge that details of this are only just coming out and we need to look at that closely. But that to me is an overstepping of even the traditional mark that civil servants are directly expressing something, moving towards an expression of power and certainly expressing a political view that is at odds with the legitimate program of the political party that has won a democratic election. So something feels off to me now.
It certainly seems that there would be an extraordinary overstretching of their muscles if basically civil servants did go on strike over a government policy they were tasked with implementing. We haven't obviously quite reached that situation yet. It's at the level of threat rather than the level of action. I was very struck, though, by another recent news story. A former minister, Andrea Jenkins, claims that in her efforts to support free speech on campus, she, in her role, wanted to speak to various free speech advocates, including Professor Kathleen Stock. And basically, she claims, Andrea Jenkins claims, that her civil servants effectively obfuscated her ability to have meetings with these people, claiming she needed permissions and all the rest of it. I came away with an abiding thought. Well, you know, ultimately ministers decide. What is stopping a minister just demanding for these things to happen? What is actually stopping a minister for picking up the phone and making a meeting themselves if one reaches this level of obfuscation? Is there not a case for saying that the triumph of the blob is actually a pretty poor reflection on the quality of government ministers who seem to lack the while or the energy to get around these road bumps?
You're right that ministers could do that kind of thing, and they sometimes do. But one of the odd pathologies that I think has crept in to ministerial politics is the advantage in terms of sheer weight of resource that the civil service has that ultimately influences decisions. So ministers, senior ministers, now go into departments, which in some cases are huge employers, with almost just a couple of spads, a couple of special advisors, who in some cases have basically been plucked out of CCHQ in the Tory case for little more than loyalty, running social media accounts, barely more than, frankly, capacity for tea making. And they're also young. Whereas in some cases, in some countries, ministers go in with large teams of experienced advisors, including some of that country's most specialist academics in that field. And they can plan strategically. So yes, ministers here can pick up the phone to whoever they like and invite them in. But ministers are busy. Ministers have constituency surgeries. Ministers have to address parliament. And so there's this informational advantage, there's this resource advantage that keeps creeping in.
I was at a dinner a few months ago sitting next to an MP who is on the Home Affairs Committee. And I was asking him about some of the things the Home Office has spent money on, not least Stonewall and its various campaigning. And I said to him, he's not a supporter of Stonewall's aims, I think it's fair to say, certainly in regard to transgender issues. But I said to him, you know, what is a Tory government doing giving taxpayers money to Stonewall? And his response was, we didn't know. And I've raised the point because I think it's illustrative of something which many people schooled in a kind of classical knowledge of how governments are responsible. It assumes that government ministers assign where money goes. And I was surprised to discover actually that civil servants appear to be spending taxpayers' money on various campaigning causes without any very obvious ministerial oversight. How can that be?
You're right, there is a problem there. Part of the problem is that when it has been demanded by some ministers that there should be, for example, a blacklist of organizations who are extreme, who are a threat to the well-being of children, and who are simply pumping out divisive propaganda that manifestly turns our society against itself. They're told that this would cause a problem with the ECHR, and the ECHR, like European membership, European Union membership before it, has become a general threat that some civil servants now use against ministers. And of course, like you say, you know, ministers can call and invite whoever they like, and a minister could spend his or her time investigating whether this was really the case in any given example about the ECHR. But mainly that's not possible because so many examples are given. And so this is used as a warning to ministers by civil servants that you may get into all sorts of trouble and there's a quagmire if you try and do this, which there are solutions to this. And ultimately, this cosmetic democracy culture can, and I think, will be solved. But the ECHR and our membership of that is something that, frankly, is one of those things that just needs to end if we are to restore a functioning democracy. So there are lots of examples of how this works from within the state. But these are the things, I think, that mean that when the British people pull the lever of a general election, it feels broken. It feels like things stay the same. It feels like only left-wing policies get through the filter. And I think that's dangerous because it's increasingly telling people that democracy is broken, that the machine is broken, that it doesn't work. And it also makes us less free. So this, for me, feels like the area that conservative politics in particular needs to look at more closely in order to enact anything else on a manifesto, in order really to get anything else done.
So let's pick up on the claim it wouldn't work well with the ECHR. What efforts really has this government made to put that great matter to the test, to run it past the ECHR, to find out whether any of this is true? And perhaps a more important question, in what way would the ECHR be in a position to determine why and when and how funding goes, for example, to a pro-trans rights campaigning charity?
Well, these are general points that are made about freedom of speech, but I think we're about to find out vis-a-vis small boats, the level of confrontation that the government is up for there. But this is just one example, I think, of the continuing sinews of the Europeanization of the British state and the culture of some civil servants, but particularly quangocrats, who regard themselves as not really beholden to ministers. And so I think ECHR is one example. Others are the fact that ministers cannot make personal hires in departments, that civil servants aren't answerable to ministers, and these things are quite different to other democracies.
I was very struck at the time of Partygate, and in fact, you referenced the Downing Street COVID parties in your introductory remarks, the photographs which were shown as evidence of the then Prime Minister Boris Johnson's involvement had pictures for him, but the civil servants whose parties they who were the primary attendees at the parties were all they all had their identities concealed. It struck me sort of a slightly curious way in which civil servants are in some way regarded as above any form of public identification and censure, even though the whole point of publishing those photographs was to suggest breaches of COVID regulation. Do you see that as symptomatic of the civil servants being held as some kind of ennobled caste?
Yes. So first, a point of sympathy, that civil servants haven't chosen to be in the public eye. So I think to a degree, it's fair that they expect that to remain. And they have chosen to be above politics, above political party politics, and that should remain the case. So they are out of that arena and out of the fray, and that's how it should be. That said, we have the rule of law and we have one law for all. And so while I don't have a strong view on whether civil servants should be in photos connected with Partygate, what is odd is that while some politicians are still being put through the ringer as a result of what did or didn't happen in those months, civil servants who have in some cases been photographed in these situations have gone on to receive royal honours afterwards and have carried on with flourishing civil service careers. So yeah, I think there is a double standard there, and it's a deeper issue that there's a kind of a performative quality now to some of the blaming of politicians for policies that, as you said, they were not told about, they had no idea about, government spending that was simply arranged in departments. We're not holding the people who make these decisions to account. We're not able to understand, partly because of the culture of the media of only looking at the behavior of politicians, we're not able to understand who is actually making these decisions. And so I think it's fair to want that to change.
Well, you teased us a few minutes ago with your suggestion that there were actually some solutions that could be tried. What do you have in mind?
The first thing is, I think party politics needs to grasp this. And so at each election, we read, for example, in a Conservative manifesto, various lofty ambitions of the party at that time, but not really the one thing that would allow them to happen, which is reform of the bloc. That needs to include different things. It needs to include bringing in serious teams of expert advisors to run departments. It needs to see civil servants become answerable to ministers for their performance. It needs to see personal appointments in and through departments, as happens in the United States, for example. There could be agreement letters signed by the minister going into the department and by the civil servants in that department about what they will achieve, say, before the next election. You could have a proper, beefy prime minister's department to create that accountability to the elected government. And there needs to be a big shift in the culture of the civil service. So the civil service is basically taking control of recruitment selection criteria, especially in the Blair years, which means they really decide who gets recruited, and this is perpetuating this groupthink. But people who have been recruited into the civil service can tell you that in the recruitment days, in their training, there's virtually no mention of the United Kingdom as a country, as a sovereign country, of patriotism, on service. It's become very corporate, very careerist, very me-centered. And so I think there's a big cultural shift that elected governments now need to try and see happen within the civil service.
Well, I'm conscious that people will say, isn't this the American style politicization of the state? What's your response? Which is something that most people in Britain do not want. What's your response to that?
My response is, frankly, no, it's not, and I don't want that either. The state has, to a big extent, become politicized, and special advisors and many civil servants can tell you that there is a left-wing groupthink that has, I'm afraid, set in. That said, I don't want a right-wing counter-groupthink. What democracy has to see happen is that when a party is elected on a manifesto, it's not obstructive from carrying out its promises to the demos. Otherwise, democracy doesn't work. And so a Labour Party that hypothetically might win an election at some point in the distant future should also be able to govern. The Conservative Party should also be able to govern. Otherwise, frustration builds among the populace in general that democracy doesn't work.
So obviously this government's only got about a year and a half or less to run, assuming a general election next autumn. It's not much time to push forward reforms of the kind you're outlining. If you had time only to get perhaps one rather limited measure through Parliament, what would it be?
Well, I think the first thing they need to do is change the way spadding works. That's something that can happen quite quickly. They need to begin the change of the civil service culture, which is something that can begin quite quickly. They need to begin the revision of the recruitment selection criteria so that a wider culture of people can go into the civil service. And the first thing of all, the most important thing at this stage, is actually carry out the bonfire of the mangoes. I don't think that should take too much parliamentary time. I think a lot of that can be done through SIs, through statutory instruments. And this is where a great deal of taxpayers' money is now spent, and a great deal of the woke sock puppet funding comes from. So for me, those are the immediate priorities.
What is your expectation that any of this will happen, or that anyone in the government is really has the strength to push this forward?
You should ask Prime Minister Sunak about that. But what we can do at this stage is make the political class in Westminster more aware of the problem.
Well, I think you make the case very strongly that the problem should be rather higher up the government's agenda than it seems to be. Radomir Taukrot, research director at the Legatum Institute, for giving us your opinion of why our democracy is cosmetic. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.